So I was thinking about the conversation yesterday, and you talking about that you didn't learn much about what's going on in history, culture, and things from school. What about your family?
Well, family taught me what they could, you know, teach, which was what I needed to. Yeah, which would be like what one needs to get by on daily basis. This is how you conduct yourself in front of your, or in the presence of your elders. And you are expected to help those who are younger, or those who'd be in need and stuff like that. Yeah, but.
Because your aunt, when we interviewed your aunt, and she was very knowledgeable about history, and she had a lot of things to say about Samane and things, but was that talked about when you were young, or
it would
not
be
so
mentioned,
much?
but never like, you know, in an engaging way. I mean, an example, say when somebody did something wrongly, oh, if Samane were here, you'd be condemned to such and such an extent, you know. So we'll get to know that there was somebody called Semani who was a disciplinarian and a task matron. Okay.
Okay, but not, yeah. Okay. So the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was how you became involved in the Making Africa Connections project and how that came about and why you wanted to be involved
in
in this project. Maybe you don't want to be involved. You've changed your mind.
No, the news came with Winani, I think, after meeting with you and getting to know her. Because she said she was working on that. What did she call it? And before this, I remember Winani again brought in a group of people from even Interpol people who were like now dealing with the eliciting of ethnographic material, I mean, trafficking and stuff like that. So I think it was through this that she got to know that there was some material culture, but Botswana material culture, which was outside. Maybe she ended up like, you know, thinking of writing or basing a thesis on that. And she met you and shared the news with you, and you had knowledge of this. And when she came back, she shared the news with us. And we were, of course, excited because that was like a missing part in our to connect with the old part. Like, of course, we have missionary stories. We have some records of Khama the Third while they were in old part. But there wasn't much about the ordinary people, you know, and what life was like, you know, that we only saw in a few pictures and a couple of paragraphs written by different people. But when it comes to the actual artifacts, we didn't have much.
Yeah. How did you feel when
you... Oh. So I think that is why we were really excited about being a part of this project.
And how did you feel when you saw the artifacts in Brighton?
Oh, the excitement grew. I mean, I couldn't believe some of the stuff. Because, like I said, a few that we saw today, or what you might see today, would be associated with certain ethnicities and not really mainstream Botswana. Even though some of us knew that this is where we came from, it was at times difficult to convince people, you know, who would see these old pictures and see our people wearing European clothes and say, no, I mean, we have, this is where we're coming from.
And when you started thinking about the exhibition and following the meetings at Brighton, can you talk about how you came up with the ideas of the things you wanted to do in terms of the contemporary collecting, which we've added, and so forth, and where that idea came from?
I think it's a lot of us always look at it like that, you know, comparing the past and the present, or trying to marry the two periods or find something common, or it's always like looking at where you are and where you're coming from. And it becomes easier for even not necessarily museum people, just ordinary folk who would visit the museum to understand this. You know.
Yeah. Mm. And there's also this idea that you've talked about telling your own stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you could just talk about that a bit.
Yeah. For many, many years, and I think even today it's still happening, we will get interviewed. People will come here, from those who know how to tell stories better, will come here, interview us, and take our stories and go and tell them. And at times when they are on the other side, they can like decide how they tell the story, reshape it, and put some words in our mouth. It doesn't happen a lot, but come on, we are people enough. We are equipped with all that it takes to tell a story. Why can't we do that? And so for quite some time, I've been like, you know, trying to find a way of how this can be done. And I think maybe that is why I'm still here at the museum. Because, yeah, that's what I do here. I tell our story. And I believe I'm doing a good job. The acknowledgement and praises I've gotten from people whom I've shown the museum have actually left me with it, you know, believe that I'm doing a good job and the museum is, you know, something meaningful. It contributes.
How have you found the interviewing process when you're saying this thing about going and recording other people's stories? How have you found the process over the last few days of doing that?
Oh, this is something that I long wanted to do, and I should have long done when there were like many, many, you know, elderly people with those stories that today we are trying to piece. And like I said, we were not supported. At some stage, we had a very good audio recorder. Unfortunately, it got stolen. It was, I think we got it when the Danes were still here. It got stolen and it was never replaced. Yeah. We could have done something really along that line. I enjoy talking to people because, that's how I learn a lot easier that way, you know. Word of mouth and interacting with people.
Mm. And you've spoken about an interest in doing more interviews, particularly in the Swapong Hills area.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, noticing that the village has moved, so there is more to what we saw there, and you know. Like, we never got to know why they moved from the old settlement and when that happened and how it happened. That's an interesting story on its own. And how has, you know, did they get what they were moving to meet, you know? Are they satisfied at the current place? I can guess that answer now with electricity and water and everything. And also get to know like where they plow during the plowing season, because there you might find some older ethnographic material. What do they plow? How do they plow? How much role do the ancestors play in their day-to-day life? Like do they consult before they go out plowing, and you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot to.
Yeah. I felt that although it's not very far, there were quite a lot of differences.
Yeah.
In terms of how they were talking about things, and the beads, for example, or the leopard tooth, and
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
talking about it quite differently to people here in the town.
Yeah, even the even the time, like, people were not in a hurry to, like, okay, come in and see what we are doing. And so, oh, boring, move on. They stayed. Yeah. Even those, like, you know, by counted 1, 2, 3 people who just came out of curiosity and just sat there and, you know, listened and, you know, be a part of what's going on and passively comment. And you, because they were not in a hurry to go anywhere. Yeah. I don't think you'll find that in Sorowa. They'll come and look at you and pass on.
Maybe. The young boy was interesting.
Yeah, also, yeah.
He wanted to see, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah, he again, that's, I don't know what the wildlife department was doing there. But I overheard something like they were going to give them some ostriches, like. People were like, we don't eat those. Someone like, no, that's good meat. Anyway, but it appears like they were at the school and they gave some lessons. And that's why this boy remembered what he remembered.
Yeah. It's interesting. So
they sometimes do those trips to try and teach people how to develop friendly behaviors towards animals and other forms of wildlife. You know.
But even here in Sorowe, people have been very patient in sitting, giving us 2 hours of their time to sit and look at these old things. I mean, they must be interested because we're not paying them.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's, yeah. Again, maybe we have that in common, like what you were asking earlier, when you heard about the material and when you saw the actual artifacts. So I think people here also have a bit of that. Once you tell them, oh, from your past, like old Palapi and, you know, during Khama's time, oh, okay, people become more, you know, curious and interested in, like, finding out what was actually happening there.
And what do you think should happen to the objects in the future?
I don't know. I would like to see us working out something that can work up for both, you know. I'm not, like, in a hurry to say return them here, because the fact that you were able to keep them safe for this many, many years, and nothing lived, not a single item. And I don't know, maybe I'm exaggerating. There might be an axe from Old Palapi that some family has, but see, this is maybe you don't, not even known of. I think up until we are trained and doing things properly, that's when maybe I can be encouraged to, like, okay, bring them home.
What's the biggest barrier to the training? Money.
Money? Yeah. And more money.
Yeah.
But I think we will get there, because like, I know the fact that you've been looking after them in this very special way, you still have that care and eye when you loan them to us. You check and see if we are capable of, you know, continuing with that, you know, their safety and that. So where we lack, you will help in correcting us. And to me, that's like some form of growth or development. We will get to learn and convince our overseers or bosses or board that this is the way to go. And maybe someday the whole museum world of Botswana will adopt this and will, you know, do a much better job than what we are doing today.
What else would you like to tell me?
What else do you want to hear?
What haven't we covered?
Yeah, I think we we have covered about enough. Maybe looking at our museum, the growth and development of this institution, or what we are trying to do here, spreading out. There are some dreams of adding on to this museum. There are one, two, or three historical buildings that we are trying to see if we can take over. And at one, we were thinking of maybe having some kind of art gallery, because now more and more young people learning art. Art is taught at school. It's part of the syllabus. And then we can encourage people to produce and show and share with the community their masterpieces. And then the second one, we were dreaming of having a museum for women, because, man, this village has produced great women. Bessie Head, a writer, even today, you know, because we have her papers, it's part of our collection. We get people coming here, like on an annual basis, we'll get a Bessie Head scholar or someone calling to find out, or, you know, sending a proposal to come and study the Bessie Head papers. We have also had Dr. Hausi Tuchepe. She was from Serowe. She was the first woman to gain that amount of education and be part of the first cabinet. And my great-grandmother, Semani, you know, who did what she did when men were fighting. She remembered and knew that they needed to keep their black bodies warm, and got women to weave their socks and things for them, you know. And then the third one, which I think will take off much faster than the others, is a museum that will be remembering the first president of this country, Sir Seretse Khama. He was also a Seruan.
So you said that you had three buildings in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the buildings?
Two are located at the main quarter, and they were former residential places for widows of former leaders. One was occupied by Teboho, who was married to Sokoma, and the other one was for Semani. Yeah.
And then the...
The last one, the third one, was used by Seretse and Ruth when they came back from England. And it was also part of where that the recent movie, United Kingdom, was shot.
And you said that you thought that might happen sooner, or that there was more...
Yeah, there is more interest and drive, and there is somebody who is like got enough muscle, who is like behind the project. So I think that one... Because the building is already restored, and we have since exchanged ideas on how to lay out the thing, the whole storyline, and so I think, and we have gotten people to look at how we can come up with a different showcases, and yeah, so I think that one, things are at an advanced stage.
And here, what about developing this site here, because you've spoken as well about, for example,
That corrugated iron building. Yeah, the idea is to move it from here, from the front to the back somewhere, find a nice spot in the garden, and set it up there, and nice it up inside, and use it as a restaurant.
And what is it, the corrugated iron building?
That's, you met the former owner. This is part of a Freeman's thing. Their shop in, what was it, Rykovs, I think, somewhere in the Butete area, that's where it was used.
Yeah. And it was one of their trading shops?
Yeah, it was one of their trading stations. And he said something like the corrugated iron came from Australia. And they should have been marked, but I don't remember seeing that Umi mark. But the ones which were on the Red House, which is the main building of the museum, were definitely from Australia. They had that Umi mark. Because I remember seeing that and, you know, confusing it with an ostrich. And we didn't know that much, because they were moved. We should have kept maybe a few, just to show how far material came from back then, and people still, yeah, managed to do that. And also have like a spot for preschool kids, you know, like they do come to the museum, and it's not an easy thing to tell them about the karma, unless we can automatically turn that into some kind of a fireside story and, you know, really catch their attention. But not all of us can do that. So we're thinking of having a little corner for them where we can have things that will engage them physically, like a jungle gym kind of thing. They get tired of this, and then you can have them in a kind of a Setswana courtyard where we can now sit down and they listen to some stories, and then we'll like take historical facts and try to make them into something that can be, you know, comprehended by the little minds.
So,
and then after that, that's when maybe they can go and see pictures and, oh, okay, it's stage by stage they'll get
it to, starts to make a sense.
Yeah.
And what were the school children who were here yesterday doing? There was a big group of school children here yesterday. Do you know?
I didn't get to like know in detail, in a fine detail, why they were here. But somewhere in the syllabus, the teachers will be asked to like visit a museum if there is one in their area.
I see.
Just to go and hear about it. And they are like encouraged to at times leave the classroom and, you know, incorporate other things, visit different government departments or, yeah. And I've always said to teachers, when you're going to make a museum tour, consult us and make us part of the planning so that we can help prepare the kids. A visit to the museum should differ from visiting a factory or a supermarket or some place, you know. We have something that we want to give kids. Okay, even at this place, you know, you get to tell them in good time so that they can prepare and know what they offer the kids and where to take them.
Yeah.
But here, you tell us what you want to cover and then we'll try to get that ready.
Yeah.
Because they come with different topics. Some would want to hear more about the three-site system, the land, cattle post, and permanent home. You know. Some want to hear about the origins of Bahab Mangwato. And then that will mean giving an introduction and following it with a short lecture on that topic, and then try to use what is exhibited, you know, to expand on that.
Anything else you would like to tell me?
Yeah, we spoke about developing and improving even the services to try and like add more life. We're talking about the lens and cattle post. If we had the capacity, like if we had a vehicle to take people around, there was a dream to do those, you know, cattle post tours and go to the lands, especially during the plowing season. Try to make this popular, like if we have people from outside especially, will take them there. And I also talked to at least one farmer, ask him to reserve a small portion where he will plow using animal draft power, so that it, you know, it can be like a demonstration of how people used to do it in the past.
Yeah.
And now that I've mentioned the lens and the kettle post, also try to document and find a way of collecting and preserving how people were doing things at the lens, because there has been a rapid change. Now government is helping people, which is a good thing, plow using tractors, and you know, it's all like machine done. And even the crops or the seeds, we are now getting improved seeds. But what of the ones that our parents, you know, brought us, are feeding us on? What happened to those? What happened to the indigenous Botswana seeds? Like Marupanzi, Pohu, these are all varieties of sorghum. You don't see a lot of those. People were like, they can't cope well in the drought. You need something that will, you know, take a short time to fruit and feed you. And it's not true, because if our breeds were not drought resistant, we would have long died out. I mean, I know that there was a time when this area was wet with lots of water, but the dry period continued, and we were still, you know, plowing and feeding. Of course, there will be periods of drought here and there, but people use those indigenous seeds to feed their families, and they coped.
So earlier you mentioned Bessie Head, and I was wondering if you could tell me how the Bessie Head papers came to be here in the Karma III Museum.
She passed on a few years, fortunately, like, I don't know if it's a year and a half or 2 years after the museum was opened. And the founding curator was like switched on to think of the papers. After we got the sad news that Bessie had passed on, she went and collected all the papers, put them in the two luggage bags, and brought them here to the museum. And then Bessie was buried. And then we engaged the son, who was the sole heir to whatever Bessie had left behind, and talked to him about selling the papers to the museum. And I think it was something like to try get a fair price. He was asked to advertise in some of the papers that I have this collection of my mother's papers, anybody interested, so that we can have an idea of what others would offer. I don't know if anybody offered anything, but long story short, he was paid the money for the papers, and they became part of our collection.
And now they've been digitized, hopefully.
Yeah, something is done in that line. We have a physical catalog. I think a lot has been done for the Bessie papers. Yeah. And looking at the number of scholars who have been here, so I think it was a good move to have them deposited at the museum.
Yeah. And visiting the museum is free?
We charge an entrance fee. When we started, we didn't charge anything. The argument being that we get government funds, and this is like, you know, charging the same person twice. People pay taxes, and this is how government make money, so why charge people? But we learned that, I don't know if it's just in this country or is it a universal one. When you're offering something free, people tend not to take it serious you know, or see any value in it. The place would be like now a spot for kids to come loiter and end up, you know, making graffiti on our walls and, you know. But since we started charging an entrance fee, when somebody comes here, they will take their time and try to get the value of their money, you know, ask questions, listen to what has been like explained. Yeah.
What is the cost?
I think it's around 15 pula for locals, or it's 20 pula for adults, and 30 for non-Botswana. So it's not really much. It's just
What else do we need to talk about? Anything else?
Yeah, I think lastly it's the struggle to try and like reach more people in many different ways. Especially today when we have the likes of Facebook and the WW thing, the World Wide Web. It would be interesting to have a thing. Oh, it is like important now to have a website where we can be like sharing with people what we are doing. If we're opening an exhibition, you put it in there, then, you know, you don't have to be a Facebook page, which won't take anything, really. I think that will do, because it won't cost us anything. I even find the energy and the means of maybe accompanying the website or Facebook page with some kind of blogging, you know, have a blog like Shed. Yeah.
So there's currently no web presence for the museum?
The National Museum has a website, and they don't even have us as a link. We are not even like linked to that. I don't know if, because I really can't justify that. I thought they would have, you know, thought of putting us as a link and carrying us. But it will happen. I think with more and more people, it's becoming more and more affordable to have someone to host the thing. So someday we'll be there. And yeah, that's why like I said I was interested in what's in Kelly's presentation, because they were presenting something like that, you know, where people can share.
Yeah, Kelly will join the project next year. I think in January, maybe a bit earlier. I think Joe's talking to her to start helping us with that, which will be exciting, I think.
Yeah. We as museums have been labeled dead institutions, and we've been like battling with this thing of bringing life to our institutions. So trying to, yeah, and it's that, and it's, people have said it in many different languages. Some would be talking about enlivening the museum. We are now talking about decolonizing, because as museums or as institutions, we also have that colonial thing, like how we were started, showcase approach. The museum must have a collection. We must like showcase, take people out, you know. But there are other things that are part of what we are dealing with in general, which is this animal called culture. Where do we put the side of, you know, performing arts? It wouldn't be it won't injure anybody to bring in or incorporate like performances of live music, for example.
What does
have some band playing here in our beautiful garden occasionally, if I can get someone to sponsor that. that way people will start, okay, some will maybe come just for music, and then they, oh, you have a craft shop here, oh, this is what is going on, oh, and see, you get more people coming, you get more life around.
What does decolonizing the museum mean? What does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know. My understanding would be like trying to move away from or add on from what has been like the main operation or way of running a museum. Bring in new things. Let's have less, you know, less fear of going wrong. Yeah, like things in showcases and labels. We try to find a way of interpreting these artifacts, like getting them to talk, like maybe even holding them in our hands instead of having this. Just look, don't touch, and yeah. Really breaking some of, making us more, a little relaxed and a bit flexible. Yeah, I think that, to me, that would be like moving away from the old way. And also our publications. Move away from the, okay, it's good to do in the scholarly way, but then think of people who don't belong there, who are like the majority, and when you're applying for funds, you are using them, it's all for the people. And now we start using this fancy language, which now makes things more appealing to us as scholars, and we forget the people that we're using when we're applying for sponsorship. So after doing our, you know, writing in that strange jargon understood only by us, let's have something that will be more pop, that will be understood by many. I think this can be done, you know. You reduce it to a level where regular people can understand what you're talking about.
Is that reducing, though? You said reduce to a level.
Well, scholars always think that they're up here and we are down here. Sorry, but... well, not... yeah. Make it more understandable. Do away with the confusion and the doubt. Like you see some of the titles that people use, and you know, that on its own will just set you off. You won't want to like look at the thing again. Long titles in the, I don't want to be confused.
No.
But if you just make it short and, you know, to the point, people, oh yeah, oh, it's about this, oh, okay.
Do the school groups pay to visit the museum as well? Does the school pay a fee, or you just...
Yeah, they do pay, but it's those who can. Kids come in a group, and the teachers can collect what they can collect. And children who can afford to pay get covered by their, you know, what other students have paid. So we'll never send any child back because they fail to pay the entrance fee. Don't do that.
No. And when you talk about having bands and having someone sponsor them, are local businesses interested in that kind of thing? Are there local businesses that would be?
They are a little difficult to deal with, but I think if we do it and do it and do it and, you know, keep on asking and asking, maybe someday someone will get tired of our asking and, you know, decide to give us something. And again, it depends on whom you talk to. If they hear you well, okay. But people will always tell you how difficult times are. But then maybe one can try with some government departments, like Department of Art and Culture. But then they also have, you see, they were given a piece of paper on how to operate. If you come with something that is maybe a little outside, it's very, very difficult. Because they would have funds to like cover an event, a cultural event. But if I apply and say, give me an X amount so that I can do these shows for this period, like maybe whole summer.
But so there's a Department of Art and Culture, but museums are not...
Part of it, yeah. But we do work together. We host their exhibitions. That is why we're talking about this March thing, you know.
So museums come under...
Animals. Wildlife. Okay. We are with the wildlife and parks. Wildlife tourism. Wildlife tourism and yeah.
And has that always been the case or?
No. When we started, we are under the Ministry of Labour and Home Affairs. And when there's a. Then we moved from there to a wildlife.
When did that happen?
Not so long ago, a couple of years ago.
Why did it happen?
I don't know, maybe they thought that we belong more there, like most of our visitors are tourists. I really don't understand how we ended up there.
Are most of your visitors tourists?
Not really. Of course, we do get tourists coming by, but I mean, we get locals also. And
School children
are like a high percentage of our visitors. They form a high percentage. I think at some stage, what I heard from the minister or the then minister of wildlife and tourism, he was he thought of transferring or moving the museums to arts and culture because he thought that's where they belonged. But then he later thought, no, I think I like museums. I'm going to keep them under my ministry. But he has been transferred, and he did a good job. He, in terms of like trying to diversify tourism, there's a guy who came in with a skydiving and air displays and inviting. What was it? The Strongman Challenge, where this like big beefcakes came and lifted huge rocks and given some seconds to perform tasks. It was. Yeah. And I think had he stayed on, he would have done something for us. Now I don't know what is going to happen.
There's an implication, though, if you say that the museums are under tourism, about who they're for, what they're for.
I don't know who... Yeah. Even at... like the time when we were at the Ministry of Labour and Home Affairs together with libraries and things, I was, why don't they put us under education? Because we'll function very well under the Ministry of Education.
Yeah. Anything else? They should be here any minute now.
Yeah. Unless we got lost.
Is that your phone?
Yeah,
that's probably
the
phone. I'll stop it.
That might be them. I've lost the word.
Okay, I'm going to stop the interview now.